Wait for it, wait for it, and we're live. Hey, all you crazy sci-fi and fantasy fans. It's time for your daily dose of shenanigans over here at the Blasters and Blades podcast. Just a couple of nerdy veterans and one chaos coordinator who is coordinating the chaos at home, so she will not be with us tonight. And we will be geeking out over our science fiction passions and fantastical fantasies. A place where magic is king, the sky is the limit, and space is the place. We are the podcast that puts the fun in dysfunction. So without further ado, before we dive into letting the guests introduce themselves, I'm going to ask you, Nick, are you liking your Starlink? Are you glad Katie Cross peer pressured you into this?
Yeah, it's so much faster than what I had before.
Outstanding. All right, so we don't need to like firebomb any houses or anything, so we're good. That was a joke, dear Spencer. That was a joke. Please don't take that seriously. Besides, her husband's Carrie, so we don't want to do that. All right, so next, we're going to let our guests introduce themselves. And in the alphabetical order of the great guru of all things professional writing, we're going to go with the Word document alphabetical order of Mr. Dave Hensley.
Hi, I'm David Hensley. I write sci-fi, fantasy, sword and pistol space opera, primarily for Three Ravens. I got some stuff in the works for Canon Publishing.
Outstanding. Next, we have Miss Diana Fedorak. Did I get it right this time?
You're close. It's Diana Fedorak, and I write all things speculative fiction. My debut novel, Children of Alpheus, came out last year. It's a dystopian colonization fic. It won several awards, and I have a sequel teed up to get published here soon, shortly, I hope.
Okay. You don't sound confident about that, but I hope.
It will be published. It's just a question of how.
Are you using the same cover artist? Because I like the art you used last time.
I'm going to try to. I'm going to see if she's available.
You should check that out. We interviewed her in season 3, dear listener. I believe it was episode 303, right around there. So check it out. Just type in her name and you should be able to find it on the YouTubes. All right, next we have the lovely Mr. J.C. Chambers III.
Howdy, everybody. I'm J.C. I write science fiction fantasy, typically high-flying action with lots of violence. Last year, I self-published Ben Ragesh, Volume 1 of the Cocoon Chronicles, which is high-flying action fantasy in a 1930s-ish style world with guns and violence and swearing, oh my. And I'm currently working on a space opera that I'm hoping to release this year.
Outstanding. And finally, we have the guru of all things sci-fi, Mr. Michael Lavoise.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Michael Lavoise, author of Galaxy's Most Wanted, book 4 coming out next month. Hey. Having a lot of fun with that. Also having a lot of fun working on my next series, which is called Gladius Leagues. And you can find Galaxy's Most Wanted at Amazon, or if you like, you could poke around my website and link to it from there, or at Athon Books. And yes, I am kind of a nerd about all things sci-fi.
Is there any truth to the rumor that you are writing a vampire werewolf forbidden love story?
No comment.
I mean, Nicky's been talking out of school. He said he read the first few chapters and it was hitting his heart, and I didn't think he had one. So
look,
I mean,
they don't sparkle. That's all I'm saying.
They should never sparkle unless they are bursting into flames.
Well, Willie Pete makes them sparkle.
Yeah, Willie Pete. That's what's gonna. That's
Willie
a good
Pete
one.
For the win.
We like JC. He gets to come back. All right. So, were you military, JC?
I am not former military. I'm not military. My dad is retired Marines, 30 years.
That explains a lot.
So
you grew up in a cult.
that's definitely one way to put it. So I don't lay any claim to the military lifestyle, but I have some familiarity with it. I grew up a lot around it.
Normal people tend not to go straight to Willie Pete. I've got nothing wrong with it. I'm here for it every day and twice on Sunday, but they just
rain fire, baby.
All right. And so next, dear listener, dear viewer at home, is how we first found all these people. So I was actually the getaway driver for their effort to liberate some gold bars from Fort Knox. But then they triple crossed me and I ended up working for my supper while they are living the high life because they didn't share any of the money with me. And I'm crying foul still. I'm a little bitter.
Yeah, because this basement just screams high life.
Never. I mean, if you were hiding money from the government, you'd fake it on camera too. I'm just saying.
Okay. Yeah, clearly I spent all my money on books and a ceiling fan.
I mean, have you seen the price of stuff at Lowe's these days? It isn't exactly cheap anymore. All right. Now, JC, because this is your first time on the show, you get to answer the religion questions. Are you ready?
Let's go.
All right, Nick, do you have the eject button ready? Because there are wrong answers. Uh-oh. Did he freeze?
I'll be sure to hang my head in shame.
All right. So, sir, the first question, Star Wars, Star Trek, or Firefly?
I got to go Star Wars.
Well, go on.
I mean, that's what I grew up on. I'm a fan of the original trilogy. This might reveal my age a bit. Phantom Menace is the first movie I remember seeing in theaters. I mean, I don't have as fond of memories of the prequels as some people do, but I did grow up on them. And out of all of those worlds, those are the ones I just, you know, even as a kid, I imagined, you know, running around and landing on planets and wielding lightsabers in the Force. And so that has a very special place in my heart for sure. Firefly and Star Trek are also great. My dad, he has Star Trek phasers on his wall. He's a huge Trekkie. You'd never know it if you just spoke to him. So there's definitely a connection there. Firefly, admittedly, I wasn't introduced to it until I was already an adult. So it doesn't have quite as, you know, deep of a place in my heart, but it's still awesome stuff.
Okay. We saw your George Lucas throne room, Nick.
So am I getting ejected?
No, that's all right, sir. All right, and because we are polytheistic here at the Blasters and Blades podcast, Game of Thrones, The Wheel of Time, or Chronicles of Narnia?
I'm going to have to go with Narnia. I enjoy The Wheel of Time for sure. It's like a thick cheese. Like you can't eat it all at once. You have to eat it over the course of, you know, a pretty long period. And I adore The Wheel of Time, but you know, Narnia again. That's what I grew up on. I loved the world that C.S. Lewis created. It was the first like portal fantasy that I really got into. I'm a fan of C.S. Lewis's other writings as well. Definitely Narnia. I am not a huge fan of George R.R. Martin's work personally, but yeah.
Okay. And because we are no longer knuckle-dragging troglodytes, Nick and I are civilized human beings now. Coffee or tea, and how do you take it?
My drink of choice is just ginger beer. It's not necessarily caffeinated, but it's the closest I can get to alcohol without drinking alcohol. I like that it has a really strong kick. It has a really strong burn, and it makes me feel like I'm actually living again on days where I feel miserable and lonely.
I should introduce you to some good beers. They will.
You're a writer, isn't that every day?
He didn't give the wrong answer of IPAs, because I'm convinced nobody actually likes IPAs. They're just a bunch of hipsters say they like
it. Even when I was a drinker, I couldn't stand those. Yeah.
I mean, if you know the story of how they were created, like, it all makes sense.
Does it involve a urinal?
Yes, and it's also okay. In the East India Company was trying to make it so their soldiers could hydrate when the water would go rancid. So, I mean, so if it was that or
different flavored rancid water.
Basically, if that is that or dying from the rancid water, I mean, you took what you had to, but to drink it willingly, I mean, that's like people that eat MREs for the fun of it. It just doesn't make any sense to me. So, all right, now that we've alienated all 12 IPA drinkers in America, we're going to move on. And we're sorry, not sorry really, but, you know, we're going to say it anyway. All right, so the topic of the panel tonight is the allure of science fiction and why we read it. And this was actually one suggested by Diana. And so we'll start with you, madam. So what is it about science fiction that speaks to you?
I think the basic thing about science fiction is that it can become scientific fact, right? We're dealing with, and because I was looking back at like what a lot of the old sci-fi authors, you know, their different quotes about science fiction. And the joke is you write about something that you hope won't happen, you know, at least if you're a dystopian writer like I am. But, you know, also like the one of the better definitions came from James Gunn, the filmmaker. And it's a conviction that we have, like this reality that we're writing about could actually come true. And man is using his intellect to do scientific change or technological change. And here's how we're going to use these tools in this story. How's that sound?
That sounded very intellectual. So clearly she wasn't one of us enlisted folks.
I like Pew. No.
All I'm saying is those alien human hybrids aren't going to make themselves, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Although whether they're dystopian or not depends on the genre.
One of the earliest things about sci-fi that I think as a young kid, it was the pew-pew and the spaceships and that kind of thing. I mean, some of the earliest sci-fi I was exposed to was in cartoon format, like when I was a kid with Thundar the Barbarian and other shows. And comic books was my first real exposure, like the Green Lantern Corps, which was very loosely based on E.E. Doc Smith Lensman series. Mm-hmm. So there were trappings of it all around me as a kid. But I didn't really start reading it until I was in my 11, 12 and almost a teenager. And then I cut my teeth on Heinlein and then I was hooked because it was all so, yeah, we could do this. You know, we could leave this planet. And okay, I don't think we're going to be figuring out astrogation with pencils and punch cards, but I think we could do this. And then as our technology base grew, so did sci-fi is kicking things out. I remember George Alec Effinger in the 80s had a series that started with a book called When Gravity Fails. And the premise of the series, it was all about wetware, getting stuff implanted in your brain that you could chip something in and change your personality or add knowledge or whatever. And that was cool. And that had been done before. But what really tripped me out was everybody had a phone on their belt. Nobody had a phone at their house. They had a phone on their belt that they took off their belt and had calls on. I thought, what a cool idea. That would be really neat. And then what happens 20 years later, everybody's got a phone on their belt. So science fiction then became science fact.
Nick and I have a panel that we do the retro movie reviews, and some of the ones we've planned and some of the prep work and we did Forbidden Planet is how much of the stuff they thought was sci-fi and futuristic back then we take for granted. And one of those of Forbidden Planet is they did have, although it was corded, they did have the phone on their belts. They had robot machines that were doing some of the work for them. And how cool was that? I kind of want that robot. He made how many 65 gallons of bourbon for him?
Right.
I mean, 60,
yeah, 65 gallons.
Yeah, who doesn't want that robot?
Right? and they were all nice bottles.
Big ginger beer, I'll take it.
Right. If they had that in the E4 Mafia, less stuff would have gotten stolen because we wouldn't be able to move. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
And then if you look at Star Trek is famous for it. You have, they predicted the flat screen stuff. Some of the Zoom type calls they were doing, and they were just guessing. They have inspired the X Prize to do the tricorder project, which somebody actually won. They got a computerized little handheld device that you punch in your symptoms. And it's obviously only scanning the known medical database. So it's not like doing AI stuff, but it can compile from your symptoms and sort of narrow it down from there. There is danger in that because who's gone into WebMD and
I was about to say it's still better than WebMD.
Yeah, you're dying of cancer no matter what symptoms you put in there.
One time I thought I was molting. It was terrible.
you've got the most famous is Michael Miguel Alcubierre, which was a Mexican physicist who invented the theory of warp drive in a mathematical formula that said it's possible. Now, the problem with his formula is it requires the energy output of the sun in its lifetime to make it work, but the math says it's possible. And so from there, it's just a matter of tailoring it and driving it down and making it. And there have been people that have done an add-on with more modern knowledge about stuff. And his is relatively modern, but I mean, there are
the exotic matter.
It's been augmented to think it's even less requires than he did. But I mean, that wouldn't have happened if I'm drawing a blank. Gene Roddenberry hadn't come up with his space western concept that became Star Trek.
Can I add one thing about sci-fi? Usually the stakes are pretty high in it. You know, there's usually, and if you think about, you know, what JC was saying for Star Wars, you know, the rebellion, the whole rebellion's going to be snuffed out if they don't win, right? Or in Aliens, it's like the whole human race against this new species, you know, with Sigourney Weaver and James Cameron. So, I mean, not necessarily all. There's some character-driven sci-fi very much, but it's usually it'd be felt on a personal level. And then a more epic scale, you'll also feel it there too.
Yeah, yeah, it's high stakes, but at the same time, it's hopeful. Like, that's the thing that's always drawn me to sci-fi is just the, I mean, even the dystopian stuff has an element of optimism built into it. It's that triumph of the human spirit over adversity. You know, it's that C.S. Lewis quote, that whole, you know, since it's so likely the children will face cruel enemies, let them at least have heard of brave knights and heroic courage. I mean, science fiction does that in spades. You know, right. Ripley is a brave knight with heroic courage against, you know, damn near insurmountable odds.
And for me, a lot of the allure isn't just the hopefulness that you'll see in certain flavors of sci-fi. It's the sense of wonder that comes with it. It's the possibility of not just what we could create, but what is simply out there. Not even stuff that we could potentially see in our lifetimes, but just stuff that could be, where the sky isn't even the limit. We've gone beyond the sky. We're in outer space, and we can create so many cool and amazing things, both from, you know, figments of our imagination and from combinations of real world phenomena that we can explore and then extrapolate to create new cool things that we would never see here in our regular lifetimes.
And to add to that, like, I remember watching some of the old sci-fi that, you know, from the 80s, I'm like, man, that's unrealistic, but it'd be kind of cool if just last week, because we're recording this at the end of February, just last week, NASA did a job announcement for anyone with tech training that wants to live in a controlled environment for a year to test what it was going to be like living on one of the Mars colonies. I mean, they're literally planning it now. And this isn't the first one they've done. This is the second or third group going in.
Isn't Shatner already doing a reality show about that?
Shatner did do the reality show. I haven't seen it because I think it's Paramount.
I saw an episode or two. It's really bad.
Like, can't
most reality TV, can it be good?
Well, you know, there is reality TV that's so bad that it's good.
Reality TV has more fiction in it than science fiction most of the time.
Yeah. You're not joking.
But so you're not giving it a ringing endorsement. Understood. It doesn't have the LaVoie seal of approval.
No,
they got to throw Sulu in there against William Shatner, and then we'll see what it turns out to be. I don't, I guess they're like mortal enemies now. I don't know.
But the idea that we went from the 80s of this is unrealistic, but it's cool, to holy crap, there are job openings. I mean, I remember when the door gunner on the space shuttle was a myth. It was a joke. It was the meme, right? And now Space Force is a thing. I mean, we're rapidly approaching the future that we dreamed about as a kid.
Well, it's a thing on an org chart somewhere.
I know they've got a TOE, but come on.
I'm friends with a guy that was in Space Force. Like, he's a DOD contractor now.
Do I think we're going to have spaceships that are, you know, fighting in the space anytime soon? Probably not. The fact is, we're a lot closer now than we ever thought possible in the 80s.
That's fair. That's fair.
I mean, we're talking about going back to the moon in the first time since,
what, 72, 73?
Yeah.
Shut those Van Allen radiation belt yahoos up. Oh, I'm so sick of those guys.
When you survive the radiation, shut up.
The funny thing is when I did some of my world building for one of the universes that Dave and I are writing in, our speculation is the first space colonies didn't actually happen because of Elon Musk or NASA. It was the Real Housewives of Mars or the Real Housewives of the Moon, because I really do believe it will be reality TV that pushes things more than.
So a possibility exists that not only did Bill Shatner do the show, he might actually get the colony.
It was entertaining, so they built a colony, yeah.
Still great. You know, that's not far off the mark, though, really. I don't think it. I mean, you look at, like, Blade Runner, what was it, 2049? And all of the advertising. It was in the first Blade Runner, too. And I just picture a space shuttle with stickers all over it, like NASCAR. all the corporate sponsors.
Yeah, or like Fifth Element, right? Like,
you know, and all the politicians wearing jackets with the same thing, I think would be good.
With zero gravity, airlines are going to figure out how to stuff even more people like sardines into a can.
Right. Probably. But can you imagine the fights at the spaceport? It'll be like the Walmart of space.
No, great. I just want to see which cults show up there trying to give you flowers as you're going through.
Complete with muumuus and leopard print leggings.
The cult of Karen.
The funny is the memes that'll come out from the flat earthers. You know it's going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's that funny scene in Independence Day where the crazy drunk guy is talking about being abducted by aliens and they're all laughing at him about how ridiculous it is in the middle of an alien invasion. I mean, yeah. You know what I mean? They're going to be those people.
Well, the drunk guy saves everybody of that movie. That's
I'm back! Great
letter. Yeah.
The power of booze. Nick and I learned that in our younger days. So other than the tech, is there anything specifically about science fiction more narrowly that speaks to you?
Yeah. I think another huge aspect of it is the social aspect, because science fiction, as a general rule, is always pushed the boundaries of what was socially acceptable. Even as long ago as the original run of Star Trek, the original series, you had the first interracial kiss on television. You had female officers, and it wasn't a big deal. Female black officers, not a big deal. They were just there because it was expected. And I think we've lost some of that in some of the newer productions because everybody wants to make a big deal out of certain traits. And I just think that older sci-fi got it right, that it would be such a normal thing that you're going to be judged on your merit and on what you bring to the table, that we've lost some of that. Yeah, she's an officer, so what? You know, who cares?
And then even farther back than that, you had Heinlein writing with Starship Troopers. Rico was a Filipino guy. He also had the female pilots because, and I've never actually looked into it myself, so I'm just taking what he wrote, but there's something, I guess women are better at repetitive motion tasks, which made them more prone to do well at the piloting. I don't know if that's true, but that was his premise on why most of the pilots were women. And that wouldn't have been common in the military of the time, but it was, I mean, he wrote about it like it was nothing.
So like I said, yeah, the social aspects have always been pushed. Star Trek did a lot of that, even with the Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. I think cyberpunk as a subgenre has done a lot for pushing things in certain directions. Yes, it's a little dystopian. It's not as hopeful as I like my sci-fi to generally be, but I do think we're drifting closer towards Gibson's Sprawl than we are Roddenberry's Clean San Francisco.
Yeah.
Well, you just had Elon Musk with his doing human trials of his computer brain interface. I mean, right now the target is people who are like paralyzed so they can walk again. But I mean, the idea of merging man and machine, which I would have thought was transhumanism and probably just the realm of fiction, is now becoming our reality.
Well, then you
I'm putting that in my brain, by the way.
Like, if you take a look at like OG sci-fi, like, well, 80s sci-fi, like you got David Weber with the Honor Harrington stuff. Like, all of his characters are great characters. And oh, by the way, some of them are black, some of them are women, some of them are, you know, multi-legged cats. And it's characters that drive the story, and it's ability and content of character over demographic checks in the box. And that still, for me, makes science fiction, you know, the genre of hope, because it means that, I mean, because when you get out into an environment like space where it's actively trying to kill you, the only thing that matters is competence. you know, The Expanse does a beautiful job of highlighting that. Like, the only thing that matters is, can you or can't you do the job? And if you can't do the job, well, you're probably not going to live very long.
I think learning, you don't live long.
I think something about this that you're like keying into is, and it doesn't just apply to necessarily, you know, traditional spacefaring science fiction or even dystopian, but just the way that we can use science fiction as almost a sociocultural fiction, where we can explore different dynamics between different peoples and different settings and do it in a way that feels believable, that doesn't feel like we're just, you know, pontificating the entire time, and we can explore how different things would play out, how different things would shake out. One of the earliest that I remember really like having that moment was, this was back in middle school. It was The Giver, and that's science fiction. It's dystopian science fiction, and it's very simplistic dystopian science fiction, but it was a really great like brain exercise and really got me thinking about the ways that people interact with each other, the way that memories and emotions and how they interact with our health as both individuals and as societies. And I think that's a really cool element of science fiction that you're able to really juxtapose really well.
So in addition to just, you know, when you talk about what's possible and some of the things they do from a social angle, you know, everyone mentions the, well, you know, when were women in this or women in that, when were minorities in this and that. But the other thing that sci-fi lets you do where there's no stakes in it is to look at social concepts. So like Star Trek did it with the racism issue with the alien race. It was like half white face, half black face. And then some of them had it inverted and they were fighting over, you know, stupid stuff. You saw that in, and I haven't watched enough of the original Battlestar Galactica, but you saw some of it, for instance, in the reboot, where their religion was familial organizations were different than, you know, Western standard. And you could look at what that looks like, what that might mean, what that might evolve into in a way that is, I mean, I don't want to say no stakes because you can influence things, but I mean, if it goes wrong, it's just on the page. You just erase it and start again, right? Or you learn that lesson. Whereas if you're trying these things in real life, people's lives are actually changed. And I like that idea of exploring social dynamics.
Yeah, and you have a controlled environment since you're the one writing the story.
Well, and the obverse of that is that because you're experimenting with social dynamics, you can inadvertently change society and lives for the good by sort of running these thought experiments on the page. I mean, Starship Troopers is a really good example of that, right? Or, you know, Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek, or The Expanse, or I can't remember the author's name, the guy who did Altered Carbon. There's a way to play with things that are not part of societal norms that allows us to explore that stuff in a way that's not only is it not harmful to society, but it kind of lets us explore the human condition.
Also the artificial condition. I mean, Gibson explored the moral, ethical and technological impacts of true AI way back in the 80s. He started playing with it in his Sprawl trilogy, but then continued in the Bridge trilogy with Hidoru, which was an AI that not only became self-aware, but actually enacted a plan to create a body for itself. So
they did that on Andromeda too, right? The AI, the machine that was the Andromeda ship that made a body for itself.
Yeah. And it's not the first time it's been done. I mean, Anne McCaffrey had the starship that searched and the starship that sang, and the ship that searched involved a human consciousness uploaded into a starship, and she wanted to create a body for herself. And she did successfully by the end of the story. And it was a really neat play on the whole, what makes us human, what makes us not human, which is a really big trope in not just pew pew space opera, but also in hard sci-fi. What makes us human? What makes us not human? You know, how human are aliens going to be? Are they even going to be something we can relate to at all? Or is our first contact going to be a virus or a bacteria?
And then the inverse of that would be, when do we stop becoming human if we make enough changes to ourselves?
Right. When do we stop being human? You know, all of those things have been explored in multiple authors. And that's another aspect of it that I love. Like, yeah, what about that? You know?
Well, that's the what if aspect of science fiction, right? You could what if like a ton of different scenarios. I just finished last night. I don't know if you guys saw it on like Apple TV Plus, but it's a great sci-fi series. It's with Rebecca Ferguson and Tim Robbins, Silo. And it's based on a series by Hugh Howey, and everybody, this huge community is underground in this silo, and you're trying to figure out why they're there, and they're all highly regulated. You're not supposed to go outside because something bad happened outside. There's a little like sensor that you could kind of see outside, and it looks, you know, desolate out there. But of course, humans are curious, and her character starts getting involved, like, yeah, why can't we go outside? You know, and but you can't say those words, because if you go outside, like everybody gathers around the sensor and watches you die. So you're like, what happened there? And what are all these social controls for? So it's a pretty good, and they're making like a second season. So if you guys haven't seen it, you know, it's worth the $5.99, you know, at Apple TV Plus, you know, to give it a look, you know. But what if like, so another what is, or you could take like a well-known premise, but, you know, give it a twist. Like there's been plenty of books and stories on Mars, you know, Mars exploration, you know, but Andy Weir did it with, well, what if I strand a guy there?
Oh, you know? That was delightful.
Yeah, I mean, that's
so good.
That's an awesome sci-fi flick. And I read the book for the first time, you know, the last year. It's hard sci-fi. It's like the guy's total MacGyver with like duct tape and, you know, everything. And he's sciencing everything. But
gotta science the shit out of it.
Yeah. But the author made such a great creative choice, because he was like, if I'm going to be explaining science, I got to make this character humorous. Right. And I got to make him funny to keep everybody laughing. And the book is like, and of course, you know, it's great casting because Matt Damon's in it. His face is on the poster. So there's like this emotional connection, you know, right there with the audience, you know, because you're like, wow, well, I don't want to see Matt Damon die. You know, I want us to go get him. But in the book, it's like he's like writing stuff to NASA that is like not in the movie, because it's like that obscene and stuff like that. And you're like, well, I can't blame him. He's been stuck here trying to stay alive for like over a year now, you know, by himself, you know. Where he could die just like at any second if like one thing fails, one system fails, his water, air, you know, CO2 scrubbers, doesn't have enough to eat, and what have you.
And he had that funny line about being the first space pirate, which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah.
So
Hugh Howey has done a lot of good experimental stuff. He had one, I can't remember the name of it, but the premise was these people were born, they were clones that were born in a vat, and then they were raised virtually in their suspended whatever until they were old enough to come out, and then they were supposed to build these colonies to literally just be worker drones for the corporation back home, and what happens when that goes wrong, and what that looks like for society, and the idea of free will versus, you know, you were designed to be that way. You know, can you rise above that? And I thought that was a really fascinating look at like culture and like, you know, where you end in biology begins. And it's, you can do a lot of that in fiction.
Well, yeah. And kind of looping back around to sort of an examination of the human condition, Altered Carbon, the TV series, the Netflix series, not the books, they generated a character who's a complete AI construct called Poe. And that dude, and I think it's either season two or season three, like he sacrifices himself for the greater good. And like, man, that hit me in the feels in a way that, you know, like he was an AI construct. He's a robot. He's not supposed to be a person, but they did such a good job of making him a relatable character that I actually shed some tears over Poe's, you know, meaningful death to sacrifice himself for, you know, Takashi Kovacs to go ahead and be successful.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, another good example of that is with the Mass Effect trilogy. One of the major themes running along the Mass Effect trilogy is when does AI become sentient? When does it have a value similar to that of a human life? When does it have a soul? And it has very moving particular moments across the trilogy that really hit you in the feels.
Yeah. Maybe it's just as I get older, it's easier to hit me in the feels. I don't know.
Star Trek did that in Measure of a Man as well, with Data a person or a machine.
You mean that I am sentient?
He's put on trial. Is that the one? Yeah. That was a good one.
And it is an interesting question. I think Asimov did it in iRobot, I believe. That came kind of concept as well. Although it's fascinating that
it's story.
Yeah, it's fascinating that every time we come back to it, we never seem to think it works out well when you create kind of quasi sentient robots.
Well, we're about to find out.
Yeah, it's I remember the hysteria when Russia was testing their robot that was supposed to do some work on their like the ISS that they were building on their own to get away from the ISS or whatever they're calling it. And there's a funny picture of the technician putting pistols in its hand and having it shoot to show how dexterous it was. And all of the Western media was like, oh, my God, Russia sending armed robots into space. It was just hilarious that it's like, I mean,
can they do that?
In a generation raised on Sarah Connor and Terminator, it's like the idea of putting guns in a robot's hand just kind of rubs you the wrong way. Or when a person whose name was Sarah Connor, not the fictional character from Terminator, unironically and accidentally tweets about a robot that crashed into another robot as they got into some sort of tiff in California. It was like the robot meter maid accidentally crashed into a robot delivery thing, and she's sharing that like – not realizing
robot on robot violence,
right?
Sad, very sad.
Yeah, it's interesting that we all come to the same conclusion.
Well, so I was just reading this today. So, 5 AI programs, it's an article like from the big tech companies, they were put in charge of fictional countries. And when there was conflict, they all reacted much more aggressively than human beings did, and they were very quick to choose nuclear war. So I thought that was interesting. I'm like, is that really a reflection of the AI technology or the human beings that are programming it?
Diana, did you read the one that the Air Force did where they had the they gamified the AI algorithm? Now, this was theoretical. It only happened in theoretical space. There was nobody harmed. This wasn't a real world test, so we'll put that out there. But they programmed the drone so that way it got points the more SAM type targets it took out, anti-air missiles for those at home. And then when the there was too many civilians around the site, the drone operator was like, no, we're going to skip that one. And the drones, well, I get more points for killing it. I don't care about civilians. So it took out its drone operator so then it could turn around and go after the target that it had told them no to.
And that's, I did read that. That's definitely something fascinating because the actual, machine learning and artificial intelligence is such stuff I've done a decent amount of reading up on. And so it tells you that at least for now, the people holding the reins, the people writing these algorithms, you really have to bank on their morality when it comes to these artificial intelligences. And so, and that's something that we've been able to explore plenty in other stories plenty of times. It's something that we've been able to explore for decades now. And it's something we're finally starting to like come to terms with in real life, because we are getting to that point where it does matter who is holding the reins of these AI.
The guy punching in the algorithm, is that a guy a believer in the zero-sum game? Because if he is, boy, are we in a world of crap.
Or is he an idiot? That's another question.
Is the village idiot programming the algorithm? Because we don't want that. I mean,
we've just seen what that can happen when you let your biases go with the recent Google Gemini stuff. So, I mean, there's definitely concerns, regardless of what you think about the bias, there's definitely concerns that the bias does affect the end product, because you have to think about like if you don't want the other side, whatever that looks like, to do it, then you can't do it yourself. And both sides of the political divide that is modern, Western culture, no my side, no your side. They forget that when they do something, they're tacitly giving permission to the other side, and you see that play out in some of the biases with the AIs that are running. I think, which is kind of fascinating to watch from a sociological sort of standpoint.
Where did you learn that word? I learned it from watching you, Dad.
All right. And with that,
Diana had something to say. She was trying to get it.
Did you, Diana?
Yeah,
Diana.
I was just thinking of all the examples that you guys were given, and you know, we're like, I guess we're still talking about it because, like, a machine or a program, it's made to do a function, right? It's programmed to do X, Y, and Z, and you know, there's limitations, you know, to the different models that they have. You know, what the machine doesn't have until one day it may have that is any type of moral judgment, right? So that's where all the human condition that you guys, you know, talk about. You know, I was also reading that the language learning models, you know, that they have for some of these popular programs now, they are by necessity, the way they program to scoop up all this data and detect the patterns, they're going to hallucinate after they hit a certain point because they're at the limits of what they know. So that's why it starts like spewing out all these things. So it's interesting, you know, the technology is more of a, I look at it as more as a functional sense. And then, you know, the judgment, you know, is left up to humans to debate and, you know, ponder and the implications of that.
Okay. Well, we're going to pause right now where we shamelessly shill for the man, and then we're going to get back to something you said, Diana, after the commercial break.
They came in peace, or so the aliens said. Here are 18 examples of their lies. Venture into the unknown with us. Who is out there? What will they want from us? Join us in the adventure of First Contact. Each story explores a different facet of aliens meeting humanity. By Contact This, a First Contact anthology, and read some of the industry's best storytellers today.
All right. Thank you for sticking with us through that commercial interlude. So right before we went into break, Diana, you mentioned something about some of the AI models, the language learning, they go a little bit nuts when they reach a certain point. They actually, I don't know if you're familiar with the Halo franchise, but they actually address that with the concept of rampancy, where if the AI gets to be a certain age, they learn so much that their core processing can't handle it and they go insane there too. They call it rampancy, but the idea of if the AI can learn, is there such a thing as too much learning? And what that looks like as well, which is kind of the inverse problem.
I think maybe that's a question of how much autonomy does AI get? You know, how much autonomy do we give it? Because like Deanna was saying, AI is programmed to serve a purpose, right? And we're going to program robots with AI intelligence to do things that we can't do, to go to places we can't go, because we're soft and squishy and very easily killed. You know, how much autonomy do we give AI to do things like mine asteroids or harvest gases from gas giants or handle bulk cargo transports from one part of the solar system to the other? I think that that autonomy is a function of how far AI can learn and how far it can go.
Well, then you have to look at it, where the line between a sophisticated algorithm and a true AI actually is. I think we use those words interchangeably when probably they're not actually artificial intelligence. They're just, you know, a sophisticated computer program.
Well, you know, that distinction between a super sophisticated computer program and an AI is not too dissimilar from the distinction between, you know, a super sophisticated program and how humans operate. And it's one of the major arguments going on around language learning models right now is as you start digging into the underlying concepts of how the algorithm works, how it collects data, how it interprets that data and then uses that data to do things, you begin to ask, okay, how different is this from the way that humans collect data, interpret data, and then use that data? Where do we draw that line? And that's, again, something that science fiction has been exploring for decades.
I love how we have the allure of sci-fi and why we read it, and we devolve into the AI and the robots.
we can talk about Star Wars.
I think it just shows that, like how rich the sci-fi, you know, genre is for all the different, you know, philosophical discussions we could have. We're just having like one aspect, you know, of it, but there's just so many.
Well, the fun one, it's actually coming about now with modern technology. Thank you, Elon Musk. But the trolley problem in regards to self-driving cars, because at a certain point in time, if the two cars you're going to crash, you have a school bus full of kids and you by yourself in your car, and the cars are being driven by the machine, do they prioritize you because it can only save one of you, or the bus full of kids? And then that, you know, the individual driver's like, wait, I don't want my car to decide it's going to kill me to save somebody else. And so you end up with those thoughts. In fact, it was an NPR episode where they talked about what that would look like back in the early aughts. And now we've got those self-driving cars and everyone's kind of just accepted it as what it is. To me, there's danger in letting the machines decide what the value of life is.
Well, that's Will Smith's iRobot right there.
Yeah, I was about to say it harkens back to Asimov's rules of robotics, where the robot's not allowed to harm human beings. And those rules filtered their way into all kinds of other sci-fi intellectual properties. I remember one great tongue-in-cheek example of it was on the television series, not the film, but the television series of Logan's Run, where they had a remarkably human-like android with them, and another Sandman had cornered Logan and the gang, and the robot... he was about to take out the robot, and the robot was, well, no, you need to move back. You need to step back and get behind that tree over there. Because, you know, and the Sandman says, oh, right, because of your rules against harming human beings, you might explode. And the robot's like, no, self-preservation. And he runs off. I was like, oh, that was brilliant. That was great. What a great tweak on the old, I can't harm humans rule. No, I'm just trying to stay alive.
What, you were going to say something, Diana? Go ahead.
Do you guys think like the marketplace is going to serve a lot of the checks of this? Is like, you know, the corporations start going, hey, I don't have to deal with humans and their complaints. And if they show up late and, you know, as they start replacing us, because I saw like this very interesting study. And, you know, and AI would just is just an example of like all the jobs it would kill. Right. And it's like all the really good paying like white collar jobs, you know, that people need a college degree for. All the jobs in the trades are pretty safe, you know, from it. So I just think about like, you know, corporate America, you know, them trying to leverage this for efficiency and, you know, finance capitalism. We're seeing some of this in Boeing right now, right? And as things start not going right, you know, the market, the consumers and customers are like, no, we don't like that. And then they're like, oh, okay, we got to go back and fix a couple things. So I do wonder, you know, if there is somewhat of a corrective mechanism there, you know, depending on how it's regulated.
Anybody here had an experience with AI-driven like customer service phone menus and like responses? I keep hearing people talk about it, but as far as I know, I haven't run into it yet.
Yeah, but a virtual assistant you're talking to and you're like, can you give me a human, you know, you know, you're like, okay, you're not going to be able to answer my question. So I'll play this three question thing, you know, whatever algorithm that you're running. And hopefully by the third question, you're saying, oh, I'm going to connect you with.
Yeah. I'm reduced to shouting obscenities at the thing and hanging up.
I used to do that too. I still do that too. You end up yelling at it and like, give me your, you know, insert obscenities, family friendly show. And if you hit zero often enough, and a lot of those, you'll eventually get an operator. Although some of them are learning, and I got hung up on a couple times. But you,
I have a meme for that. It's like, yeah, it's got a possum that's just like screaming. It's like, human! I want a human!
So they actually did, you see some of that with the automation when they started raising the minimum wage. The businesses were like, I don't have to pay that. I'm going to do self-checkout machines at the grocery store and self-checkout machine at the fast food restaurant. And then they're constantly lowering, essentially entry-level work is disappearing, and you end up with either the trades or the white collar. And everyone's mostly okay with it because it's affecting someone else. But I think Diana's right. Once it hits the white collar stuff, these people that spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on their college degree that might or might not be useless are like, wait a minute, I still got to pay that back and I can't get a job. Stuff is not right.
Good luck replacing a carpenter.
Yeah.
I think historically speaking, the general rule has been, whenever there is a new innovation, typically you'll see some jobs lost, but the overall net, you know, work gained will fill that void. However, we don't know if that's going to hold true for AI. But a decent example is, okay, so we have the automated customer service, right? And that can be a problem because it means, okay, these big corporations may not need as many call center employees. But on the flip side of that, you know, as a small content creator, I can have a website that can field customers' complaints using an AI. I don't have to spend all my time doing that. I can spend my time building content and growing my own business. So how much that flips, you know, that equilibrium shakes out to, I could not begin to tell you. But it's something to keep in mind is that it may not entirely be bad. It certainly can be bad. I got laid off at the end of last year. It sucks. But I am hopeful to see how this shakes out. I'm hoping things turn out better than they were.
So I would say that I get what you're saying. When the saddle makers were replaced with the cars, you still end up having someone making something and working with their hands. Now, as those jobs are getting replaced, they're becoming more and more technical, and not everyone has the temperament to write code, right? And at a certain point in time, code gets recycled and you only need so many of those as well. So I don't think the old model where you're talking about the Luddites kind of thing, I don't know that that's going to hold true as things get more and more technical, because if everyone could do it, it wouldn't be as big of a deal as it is right? To do the computer, the tech stuff.
Well, at some point you've got it. I mean, you can be the best buggy whip maker in the world, but when cars come along and replace horses, you got to find another thing to make, because buggy whips are out of, you know, they're just no longer useful. And so either as humanity, we embrace the change and find another way to be useful, which humanity is very good at. Like, you know, for all of our faults, we're very good at finding a way to adapt to present circumstances, whatever those circumstances happen to be, which is back to that allure of science fiction. You know, it's the adaptability of the human spirit given, you know, for any given value of adversity.
So given that we're talking about like what the hopefulness of sci-fi, what's everyone's take then on the common theme where those colony planets look more and more primitive and throwback instead of futuristic and, you know, oh, cool, look at this tech. Because, I mean, how often do you see like Firefly did it, where the planet looks like it's the Old West, you know, because, oh, it's cheaper than getting all that technology to them. You know, at a certain point in time, do you think we step backwards in tech when we go to these other places, presuming that they're habitable without like suits and such?
I think it's going to be a function of the environment, you know, because colonizing a planet is right now, you know, very difficult. And, you know, for human beings to survive, it's got to, you know, there's a certain Goldilocks zone that the planet has to, it's got to have water, right? So it can't be a gas giant. It's got to have mass. It's got to be, you know, a rocky planet. And, you know, even, you know, with Mars, with the changes in gravity, you're dealing with like health effects, you know, on the body. And so in that scenario, just using Mars, because that's, you know, one that kind of a reference point that everybody knows, I do think the technology, you know, will help it. I don't know if it'll be primitive, but I think it'll, you know, help with the colonization piece of it. Although you did say, I don't want to like derail the conversation, but, you know, since you brought it up with other planets, I also think like that's a really cool thing about sci-fi and like why we like to read it and watch it, because of the world building and all the different environments that, you know, we could put human beings in. And the movie Dune's coming out, I think next weekend, and I'm really looking forward to it. I'm going to drag my kids. They're going to complain, but I don't care.
I'm super stoked for that. Like, I think it's going to be pretty awesome.
So,
okay,
you know, Andy, you're doing it right.
But the world building is part of the exploration of what it means to be human, right? That's part of why you do it the way you do.
That's right.
And that is, I think, that still goes back to what we love about science fiction, sure, more narrowly.
One of the running themes in Galaxy's Most Wanted that I had the most fun writing, that I've gotten quite a bit of feedback from readers that they've had a lot of fun reading, is I have an artificial intelligence that runs a starship. His name is Hexpalus, and this is his first contact with humans. And he chooses my main character to be the pilot of his ship that he runs. And over the course of the book and the next several books, he learns all kinds of weird stuff about humans and how we're just kind of weird, bent creatures. And his society that he comes from doesn't even use fictional narrative as a device. And yet we do it all the time. It's just all these little things. So you can explore and kind of look at humanity from the outside. And so, man, we're weird. Even aliens think we're weird, you know, to me, that's a lot of fun to explore, especially since I was using like an artificial intelligence to do it with, because you can get that kind of literal take on things that the main character would say, as opposed to another creature that also uses idiom and slang and understands the use thereof. But it's just another way to explore humanity just from the outside looking in.
Okay. I do think there's a robots in science fiction are weird, though, because sometimes they are just stand in to allow you to explore the human conditions. And then sometimes they're actual sentience, and sometimes they're just machines that do a task. And so I think there's room for that one to depend on the intent of the actual creation by the author of the story. I mean, like, obviously, Data was supposed to be an actual person who just, oh, by the way, he's an android, whereas some of the others were more utilitarian. We Are Bob, We Are Legion. It was exploration of the psyche. I mean, it just, I think it depends on the intent of the person sitting down and telling the tale as far as what their usefulness is.
Well, like, you know, in Blade Runner, like the 2049 one, he's got the Ryan Gosling, he's got the OS. And this was also done in Her with Joaquin Phoenix, where his girlfriend is essentially a program, right? You know, and I, another thing that caught my eye is, so now they have apps, and I'm like, I don't want to see these people's browser settings, but they could have it's like you can name her and you can have her respond to you a certain way and pick her temperament. And you could put your ex's picture. Or I'm like, oh my gosh, do we
one head
you lonely dude. One
head did a whole show about those.
There was actually a funny meme about, New York Times article about how the sex robots, which is, you know, one of the evolutions that people think, would actually potentially be used to kill you. And I'm like, so you just circled back to Terminator is basically what you're telling us. And this
Terminator 3 specifically.
What's that?
Terminator 3 specifically.
Yeah, so
that's right. Yeah.
Weaponized loneliness has dangerous consequences, I guess. Which then goes back to, what does it mean to be human? Because as we disconnect, do we lose our humanity? Which is we're seeing play out in real time. Which makes some of those sci-fi themes hit a little closer to home when you read about it. I don't know that there's a right answer, though, which is part of the fun.
I think that just seems to be the theme with the majority of sci-fi, is that question, what makes us human? Where do we draw the line?
So let me ask you this then, because your exposure, as a creator is in the comic book space. Does sci-fi look different when you're talking about it pictorially with your comics, your manga, your whatever graphic novels? Is it still sci-fi is sci-fi is sci-fi, or does it change based on the medium?
No, I don't, whether it's comics or superheroes, capes and cowl stuff, you're still dealing with that question. What does it mean to be human? And you're dealing with that with your protagonist, your hero, because they're going to have to make hard choices. I got characters that are a little bit gray on morals, as far as like where they see the lines a little bit further out to cross than say like Superman or, you know, things like that. So I think it's the same question. It's just in a different medium.
I'm not sure I would completely agree that that's like the core question of, you know, most sci-fi. I think the beauty of sci-fi is that it's able to explore all of the different themes and questions that normal fiction does, but it's able to do it in fantastic and sometimes very creative ways. To your point, I mean, Gundam does explore what it means to be human. You have the humans versus the new types, and that's something that they do explore, but they also explore so many other things. They explore pacifism, they explore the horrors of war, which doesn't necessarily have to do with what it means to be human, just what are the horrors of war. So I wouldn't necessarily say that entirely, but yeah, you can use sci-fi to really drive. You can use inhuman elements to drive into what makes people human.
The main point. That's not what I was saying. I was saying that question is almost in every scientific sci-fi fiction. I think it deals with social constructs, social norms, stuff like that. One of my favorite series growing up was Alien Nation. Anybody else watch that? Am I alone here? dealt with racism quite a bit.
It was good.
I don't know why I loved that show. And then come to find out, I'm like, there was a movie about that, because I was young and didn't have access to R-rated movies all the time.
You talk about what it means to be human, and we've talked about, from the robot angle, we haven't really thought about where the line between transhumanism and selective breeding is, because you see that if anybody's seen Gattaca, Tom Cruise that was in that one, if I'm remembering correctly?
No, Ethan Hawke.
Ethan Hawke, Jude Law.
Yeah, it's Ethan Hawke.
And Uma Thurman.
And Jude Law, yeah.
But at a certain point in time, are you still human in a world where everyone else has been selectively bred for the best traits by a scientist in a lab, and you're the only one born, the only known one born the old-fashioned way, accidentally? What does that look like? Are you still human now that you're the odd man out, or are you something else? And where that line is and what that does to society, it's an interesting kind of thought experiment that goes the other direction.
And that's not the first time that's been talked. Brave New World.
Go on.
It's also a commentary.
Selective reading aspect.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, Nick. Well, it's also a commentary. No. I think it's like a given that those characters are human, but it's also how we treat one another. And it gets into social organization and political organization and economic organization. Mm-hmm. So if you look at The Island, right?
Ooh, good one.
Which is a Michael Bay flick. And I think Ewan McGregor was in it and Scarlett Johansson. And so they're clones, right? They're made to be harvested. And you're like, what? Okay. Should we outlaw that? Maybe because all their sponsors think that they're not sentient beings, right? That they're just produced in a lab.
They're spare parts.
They're very much not. They figured out that the only way to get the organs to their full potential is to actually breed them all around. And when time comes, they just get sent to the island. So a lot of it. So that's why I'd say is how you politically and socially, organize society, what economically should be allowed. I think that also tends to be a theme and discussion points that we have.
Elizabeth Moon has a really great book. It's older, right? It's late 90s, early 2000s, called The Speed of Dark, where the protagonist, the main character, is autistic, but his autism is being neural atypical, makes him the perfect candidate for their space program for handling calculations and navigational stuff. And towards the end of the novel, spoilers if you haven't read it, he's faced with a choice. Does he allow them to give him a treatment to undergo a procedure that will strip the autism from him and make him more neurotypical so that he can go out into space? Or does he stay the way he is and continue to be a benefit to humanity by helping move the space program along? And it's really sort of examines humanity the way it presently exists and sort of the utility we have in our society based on, how we're wired up, rather than, how different we can be.
A great word to bring up, though, because I remember one of my favorite storylines, not storylines, but topics covered in, believe it or not, BattleTech, was when the Klans were introduced. And they have a very rigid caste society, talking about, back to Deanna's points about how you're set up politically and socially. They were a very rigid caste system, and the warrior caste was on top. So guess who gets all the money? But beyond that, they genetically program their people in that caste, and they have a term for people who were born the old-fashioned way, and it's a derogatory term. They're called free birth, and it's always said with an air of disgust, free birth, you know, like you're inferior. But some of these free birth people who were made the old fashioned way with the genetic Yahtzee role became some of their greatest warriors and some of their greatest people. And it was that dynamic of genetic programming versus the old fashioned way that I found very, very fascinating to read.
They did that when you talk about back to what David said about the autism as potentially a benefit to the scientific advancement. Hugh Howey covered that in the idea that if you're going to send someone to observe a colony planet from a space station to just observe society and sort of follow that Star Trek main directive where you don't interfere kind of vibe, they picked intentionally so people that were autistic because they were better at being alone, so they didn't have to interact as well. And you saw some of back to like the selective breeding. You saw some of that like with the island in the movie My Sister's Keeper, which is quasi spec fic. It's not really science fiction, but it kind of skirts the line, I think, where this younger sibling was born to donate her body parts, her extras, whatever, to her sister with a terminal disease, and the morality of what that looks like when you commodify humanity. And I broke the internet because everyone got silent. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. Dead air.
I mean, that is like a deep podcast. I thought we were going to just...
I thought we were going to talk about how much we love Star Wars. No, I think you guys are touching on it really well, which is transhumanism can go one of two ways. It can go the Cyberpunk 2077 route, where it's like, if you modify yourself so much, do you just lose what it means to be human internally? Like, do you just lose yourself and become overloaded by those changes? And then you have the concept of transhumanism that we're seeing in what we've been discussing so far, which is, do we have a right? Is it okay for us to make these modifications to people? Can we define what it means to be human? Because so many people deviate from a specific norm that, if we try to quantify what it means to be human and what are good human traits, then we could potentially have a human rights crisis on our hands, or horrifying things can happen. And we saw that happen with World War II, with the Nazis, where they quantified what it meant to be human. And so it's definitely a interesting take.
When you go to
James S.
Go ahead, Dave.
James S. A. Corey explores that with the in the Expanse, with the differences between the Belters and the inner planets, the inners. The Belters are like so much time has been spent in microgravity and low gravity that they are kind of, genetically, they've become a different species of Homo sapiens. That, you can't take a Belter and drop them in a gravity well and expect them to do well. Like, it's painful and miserable for them. And so there's a divergence of the species there, but they're still human.
Are they? So that's an interesting question. When back to what JC was saying about the transhumanism angle, that's a common trope in science fiction, is what happens if you go too far, where the alien species or the human species that change themselves so much they can no longer reproduce and they're in danger of dying out if they don't try to revert back to the base programming, as it were. And what that does to a society as well, if you stare into the abyss too deeply and it changes you.
Stares back.
Well, it depends also who's in charge and what they value. Maybe, what species they value. So.
And that's another interesting thing that you see in real life too, that science fiction kind of explores, is do we actually value human life? Because there are some that would like to see a lot less humans existing. There's a whole movement in modern times, it gets political, so we're going to skirt around it, but that really thinks there should only be about 500,000 people on the planet. And then you have the exact opposite with Elon, who says, no, we need more people if we're going to specialize, because specialization takes more bodies than less.
So this actually ties way back into your question that you made about what would life be like on these other colonies. Would we go regress in technology? And there's really two answers to that question. The first is, it's the same question as what wins wars. It's logistics, supply lines. If you have enough supply lines and logistics, you'll be able to get technology to places. But supposing you don't have the logistical capacity to like bring stuff to these colonies regularly, the only way you're going to achieve similar levels of technology at these different places is if you have enough people. If you don't have enough people, you won't have the workforce necessary, the brain force necessary to replicate what we have here. So if we want to be settling these other planets, we need to tell Malthus to go screw himself, and we need to have lots of people.
Well, the other interesting thing is why I think you see so much of the Old West in space as a theme is because the West for a long time was humanity's escape valve, right? When things got to be too much pressure in Europe and, you know, they didn't like you for whatever reason, well, screw you, I'm taking my ball and I'm going West, right? And so what happens when we colonized all of the West, you know, the West being in air quotes here, and you have nowhere for that pressure in society to go, you end up with more martial conflict. Well, if you could reopen space as another frontier, you know, as they say in Star Trek, the final frontier, suddenly the malcontents who just want to take their ball and go home and live on the edges can do that instead of bringing society down. And so it kind of makes sense that those stories would be told in an analog of the Old West, even if that's not necessarily how they might live were they truly to colonize.
Well, and it gives us the ability to explore, you know, our ability to differentiate ourselves as a species, right? Because inevitably humanity is filled up with either rule followers or people who don't give a damn about the rules. And the people who don't give a damn about the rules are the ones that are always pushing towards the outside, the ones that are pushing towards the frontier, the ones that are going to take their soccer ball and go somewhere else. Because it's less restrictive. It's like the Malcolm Riddles of society, of humanity. And with an open frontier like that, it gives those guys a place to go, but it also creates an environment for endless innovation. You drop however many people it takes to colonize a planet on that planet, and it doesn't matter what you drop them with, as long as they can survive, they're going to find a way to innovate new technology to make their lives easier. That's just the way humanity is. Like that's the thing that makes us apex predators, is our ability to innovate and adapt to any given environment, given enough time.
Life finds a way, as they say.
Laziness is its father.
And that does, I mean, it's that old joke that you learn as a historian is, you know, well-behaved people rarely make history. There's a reason that those people stand out. But as society, for various reasons, becomes more conformist, which is another trope of science fiction that you see a lot of, is the conformity versus the individuality and what the role of each is in a functioning society. You see more of that play out once you reopen a frontier because people have the ability to walk away. I mean, we have whole sports created by the idea, I'm going to take my ball and go home. Anybody who knows the history of rugby, for instance, it started in a soccer game and someone said, I don't like the way you're playing. It's kids, actually, in Rugby England. One of the kids said, I'm going to take my ball and go home. And the other kid says, like hell you are. And they started fighting and a game was born. That is quintessentially human nature, those two, the yin and the yang, right? The two polar distinctions.
It's agreeableness versus disagreeableness. That's one of the big five, you know, psychological traits, what like David was talking about. It's like the agreeable people like want harmony, and that's a good thing, you know, so they're a little bit more malleable. The disagreeable people may make everybody angry in the room, but they also have a higher chance of moving the Overton window because they're pointing out something really uncomfortable that has to be dealt with. So yep.
Well, and when the chips are down, when everything goes to hell in a handbasket, you want the disagreeable dude in your team, right? Because the disagreeable guy is going to be the one who makes the hard calls that keeps everybody alive long enough to get society back to where you can be agreeable again and survive as agreeable people.
You know what I have to say to that, David? You want the truth? You can't handle the truth. Colonel Jessup is the quintessential example of that, but you know, you mentioned part of the fun of science fiction. I'm going to turn this to a slightly different direction so we don't like narrow our focus, because there's room for that in future interviews. Diana, you mentioned one of the fun aspects of science fiction is the concept of world building, because you can play with these ideas because you're not limited by Earth, so all things are possible. You see some of that. For instance, years ago, I remember the College of Cardinals, which is a function of the Catholic Church, had a panel where they were deciding at what point in time is this a sentient creature and this thus one of God's creatures and you can't kill it? And at what point in time do we determine it's a space cow and makes nice steaks? And so you see some of that in science fiction is that idea of what morality looks like once we leave Earth. Are we being immoral by even landing there because we're introducing potentially new pathogens and destroying the native fauna and flora? I mean, like, where those lines of morality when it comes to colonization is a fun thing to play with in science fiction.
Yeah, the Star Trek had a, it was the later Star Trek movie with Chris Pine. That was like part of the plot. Like they landed, they were observing like a race, but because they were, it was tiered and that they were very primitive, they weren't supposed to be seen. Yeah, because that it could completely change like the natural course of this society. Do you guys remember that?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So
and then the,
yeah,
when the starship came out of the water, they started praying to it and they drew it on the ground. And
that's a theme of Stargate too, the Stargate franchise with where the gods of the old world, the ancient Egyptians, Greeks, whatever, were actually just aliens. They wanted free labor, so they pretended to be gods.
I mean, shifting it slightly, sometimes it's fun to do world building and what is, not necessarily because we're exploring a certain societal thing, but just because it's cool. Lately, I've been reading Time Trials by M.A. Rothman and D.J. Butler. I think I'm about halfway through the book, so maybe there's going to be something like really revelatory at the end. I don't know. But right now, it's just fun. It's really cool fun because it's a bunch of really smart people who get sent so 6,000 years back in time to ancient Africa, and like the purpose isn't necessarily to explore these social dynamics, but they do a very good job of it because it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, the rule of cool is part of the fun of fiction. I don't know that it's necessarily limited to science fiction, but it's definitely part of the fun of science fiction is there's a lot more room to make it up. You're not constrained by modern availability of technology and such.
And to that point, they use real world survival techniques, real world scientific properties, real world astronomy to determine what like general time era it is. Like that's how they know they're not dreaming, that they're actually like sent back in time is through astronomy. So it was all to service this really freaking cool story that I'm really enjoying and I really can't wait to finish it.
Time travel is like, I enjoy reading it. I haven't written that. I imagine it's hard to write because of like all, you know, the rules and you got to like think through like the implications and that it's almost like it's, you know, circular if you go like really down the rabbit hole with that. And also with, this is sort of a world building, but like altered realities, you know, is also a big part of science fiction. And like Total Recall would be an example, or the old one, you know, with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where he thinks like Sharon Stone's his wife, but really they like mess with his memory. And so he's like living in a completely different reality, like a constructed world for him. And then he's trying to figure out what the truth is when he goes to Mars.
Yeah. Christopher Nolan does a good job with that in Memento. I mean, it's not really sci-fi, but it really explores altered reality based on human perception, you know, where it starts with this guy's inability to form long-term memories. So he has to leave himself, you know, photographs and tattoos and notes to figure out why in the heck, you know, his wife is dead. But it's the same concept. Like our reality is perception for humanity. Like if you were to plug us into a virtual reality rig that completely mimicked every sense that we have, we wouldn't know the difference. We wouldn't have, there's no way for us to know the difference.
Nick is screwed that if he ever gets dementia, because he's got all that Star Wars stuff. He's going to really think he was like a Mandalorian or a stormtrooper or something because he's got the whole uniform. He's screwed.
Keep an eye on the news for crazy men at Walmart.
Well, it's like the meme where it says, I'm going to hang a Batman cowl and cape in my closet to mess with myself when I get Alzheimer's.
I tell my wife when I die, I want her to put me in a Superman outfit and drop me out of a plane.
There's a whole, dark humor, funny train we could go on with that. Nick and I have had this conversation offline, but we don't want to scare the normies, so we'll just move on.
Moving on.
I do like the Superman idea, so I'm just saying, who knew that turkeys couldn't fly? And that joke goes all the way back.
Les Nessman in the Great Turkey Drop.
So what kind of, you know, back to the world building, since you've written colonization long fiction, what kind of moral quandaries did you consider when you were planning that series, Diana?
Evolution is a big one because of the environment. I mean, that's what we're what we're built for, you know, for survival. So on another planet in a couple of generations, there's going to be different mutations happening pretty quickly. You know, so that's so the moral quandary is that I explored in my novel was, is it better to let that happen organically with the humans on the planet, you know, as they're reproducing, or should we direct it? And then who would direct it, right? That goes to the question.
Interesting.
Yep. Should it be a corporation that directs it? Should it be the government? Or should we let Mother Nature on another planet take care of it, you know?
Yeah, that's a great question. Like, who gets to decide which direction human evolution takes?
I think it comes down to who can convince enough people to pick up guns and work for them.
You definitely don't want to let it go by internet vote. You're going to end up with Bodie McBoatface. The power of stupid people in masses. But I do think that is part of the fun of where I like reading about these colonization stories is that exploration where everything is new again. I mean, you could go, like, when you go, you know, you read, oh, they're going to insert random country. Well, you know a little bit about that country because, you know, we exist on Earth, grew up studying it in school. When you start reading science fiction and you go places, you've never been there before, which is everything is new again. I think that's some of the allure as well.
Well, that's one of the neat things about the human condition in general, right? There's some studies that indicate that the human brain doesn't really differentiate from experiences that we get from reading a novel from actual lived experience. Like, we read these, you know, depending on how much of a reader you are, you read, you know, 70, 80 stories in a year about, you know, in science fiction about colonizing different planets and experiencing different things. Your brain doesn't know the difference between that and actual lived experience. And so in a way, it allows us to sort of reprogram ourselves for stuff that we just can't experience physically in our own, you know, here and now.
And that's one of the things Hugh Howey sort of dove into with his about the clones that were raised in a vat and had implanted memories so that way they could be the perfect worker bees for the corporation back home is where those lines actually are for humanity, which is part, like we keep coming back to, is part of what makes it fun is we can sort of explore those ideas where the consequences are, well, the book might suck or the movie or the graphic novel or whatever.
If you have good characters and good world building, I mean, I think you could, you know, explore those, you know, that's like the deep layer, the invisible layer, right? Hopefully, you know, well, it depends the way your writing technique, but I think it's more effective if those themes are deep layer, but it's expressed in your characters and how they interact and, you know, what type of conclusion you're driving your plot towards.
Yeah. And some of the fun is when you get the short content, which is why I love short content so much, is because they have the time investment is so low. You can get some of those wacky ideas where maybe even the author doesn't know the right answer. They're just sort of figuring it out as they go.
Yeah. So, I mean, I kind of alluded to this before and, you know, so you asked like what, like are some other of the moral quandaries. So I was looking at like speciation, you know, where, you know, evolution, however it's decided. So like, what do you do with like the naturally born humans and like the, and I'm saying what? So I had to come up with something. I'm like, well, you give them like a protection, like you would an indigenous society, or species or endangered species that you don't want to go extinct. So that was the template, you know, that I use, but there's different, you know, ways you could tackle that or not, depending what kind of society that you're building, you know. And I'll leave it at that before I get off on another philosophical trail.
Well, I've definitely got future topics on this one, which should be fun to dive into. And we're definitely going to come back to some of these AI, robots, transhumanism, and the like. But we are at the hour and a half mark, and I promised people that they could actually eat their dinner while it was still hot. And I don't want Nick to get stabbed again for being late to dinner. So we're going to go around and let everyone – I mean, we don't judge your personal life, but we just don't want to talk about it on air anymore.
Stabbed over pork chops, man.
Pork chops are delicious. It's shake and bake, and I help.
Yeah.
So if you're old enough to remember that commercial, we can be friends. So with that being said, I'll be like – Yeah, I'm going to let everyone tell what they're working on and then how listeners can find them so we can get these people back. And so we're going to start at the top and work our way around. So, Diana.
Okay, you could go to my website, www.dianafedorak.com, and look up my debut novel, Children of Alpheos. I have a map there that you could look at the world. That I built, and a free prologue. And there's an excerpt in that prologue of a textbook that describes the planet and its geography to help set up so you understand my characters and what they're dealing with. And I'm also on social media, and all those links are on my website. The one I'm using the most right now is Instagram, but I'm also on Facebook, Twitter. I'm on there, but it's not like a regular presence.
And what are you writing right now?
I have a draft manuscript of the sequel to that novel. So it's a planned trilogy. So this is the second one.
Okay. And Michael LaVoice, what are you writing right now? And how can listeners and readers and viewers at home find you to stalk you on the interwebs?
Please don't stalk me. I'm so boring outside of when I'm not writing. Right now, I'm currently working on book two of my next series, which is called Gladius Leagues. It's set in speaking of colonization, a future where humanity has colonized all over the place, but we never found any aliens. And we're kind of wondering why. We've ended warfare by having warfare by proxy via a combat sport that is broadcast all over space called the Gladius Leagues. And it's kind of like a mix of the NFL, the WWE, and MechWarrior. So what happens is aliens attack, and our only line of defense, since we no longer have standing armies and navies, is a bunch of prima donna athletes in powered armor. That's what I'm working on now, book two of that. You can find me at michaellavoice.com. I'm on Facebook quite a bit. You can also find me on TwitX occasionally.
Outstanding. And next we have Mr. David Hensley.
I'm working on my current project is called Ghost Ship Derelict. It's book one of a trilogy, possibly more, set in a far, far future of humanity where we have colonized and explored multiple galaxies. And the crew of the Dagnan Federation ship Hughes has stumbled across a derelict ship that's been missing for 20 years. And when they deploy the Legion aboard to ostensibly rescue the lost crew, they discover that there is no crew and that there are spider bots that have run amok. And so the rest of the novel is all about the couple of squads from the Dagnan Federation Legion, 4th Platoon of Pike Company, surviving a rather nasty experience aboard a derelict starship, hence the term ghost ship derelict. You can find me at davidwhensley.com. And I'm on Facebook at David Hensley Writes. And the ghost ship derelict project is in collaboration with JR. And it's been a really cool ride.
This is the world where we started space colonization with the Real Housewives of the Lunar Colony and then Mars, because I really thought that would. And when we did the world building, before I brought David on, I did predict Brexit almost down to the month. I was only off by 1 month. So, you know, we're doing something right. And David's been a lot of fun to work with because he knows like Navy stuff. Apparently my Navy was two Army, so he fixed it for me.
That's okay. My army is two Navy, which you'll certainly sort out when I pass this draft of derelict off to you to, you know, fix my army FUBAR.
Absolutely. All right. So next we have Mr. J.C. Chambers the Third.
Yeah. So you can find me at jcthethird.com. So jcthethird.com. I'm also, I have a public profile on Facebook and on Twitter X and Patreon. But what I'm working on right now is I am working on a space opera, which is Arthurian legend in space. I'm bringing in some hard sci-fi elements. The opening chapters take place on O'Neill cylinder as a heist, but there's also these magic crystals and stuff, and so you have functionally space wizards and all sorts of shenanigans, and it's hyper violent and high flying action and adventure, and I'm having a blast writing it, so I'm really looking forward to sharing it.
You had us at Arthurian Legends in Space. I've written some of that for a game company, and I know Nick is actually developing a comic, The Pendragon something, with Janet S. Brown. Yeah, from a longtime frequent visitor of the show. There's something about bringing all of that old mythology and lore into science fiction that's fun. Make a note of that, Nick. We're going to make that a panel topic again because everyone does it for a reason. And we can bring everyone.
The dragon was part alien. That's why he was able to do the things that he could do.
I just thought he drank his Ovaltine and had his Rippets.
Oh, see? Now I got to put the banner up.
That's the banner. All right, Nick. Other than The Last Pendragon that you're co-creating the comic book with Jana S. Brown, what are you working on at the moment? And remember, your pork chops are good.
Right now, we're working with our first speedster in the Apogee universe named Quickwire. It takes place in Dallas, Texas. It's hilarious, you know, as you expect from a speedster comic. So you can definitely tell that was everybody involved, including myself, were definitely influenced by Barry Allen, Flash, and Wally West. And it's been fun. The artist is killing it right now. So that'll be out sometime this year. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Ah, freaking standing. And you can find us, dear listener, on our link tree, linktr.ee/Blasters and Blades Podcast. Again, linktree.com/Blasters and Blades Podcast, where we link to all the things, the bit shoots, the rumbles, the YouTubes, the Twitters. We have our email address for professional purposes only. If you want to book with the show, blastersandbladespodcast@gmail.com. We link to our Facebook group and our new Facebook page. Be sure to hit the likes, follow, subscribe, do all the things. You know what to do. And finally, we link to Madam Stabby Stab's Instagram, Twitter, and email. So if you like our discussions about all things horrific, she shares all the cool memes. And sometimes I beat her to it and steal them first from her. Even she gets really mad though and stabs Nick. It's a brutal affair. You can follow us on our website, anchor.fm/blasterstackandtackblades. Again, anchor.fm/blasterstackandtackblades, where for as little as 99 cents a month, you can help keep the lights on. These episodes aren't free to produce, and we appreciate your patronage. Or you can support the show more directly at buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Hanley. Again, buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Hanley. Be sure to put in the comment section that is for the podcast. And I promise I will keep my co-hosts duly caffeinated. They will drink until they float away on a river of Java. It's the only way to drink it. All the goodness. All right. And you can also support the show if you want some American roasted and American packaged coffee company. We are affiliates with the coffee brand Coffee Company. Use the code PODCASTGRUNTS for 10% off. It's delicious. It's what Nick and I drink now, mostly because we've gotten bougie with our coffee taste as we've gotten older. So why not?
The flavors are amazing, man.
Yeah. And I've gotten to where I'm mixing and matching some of theirs, which we won't talk about to them because they might get offended. It might be sacrilegious. I don't know. But I've been mixing the cinnamon roll one with the blueberry one. So it's blueberry cinnamon roll. And it's actually pretty
good. I mixed the blueberry with the bourbon one.
No, no. When you say bourbon one, do you mean you actually mix bourbon with it? Because I'm cool with that. Or
No.
Michael looks a little offended.
They're bourbon flavored coffee.
It's too frou-frou for me. So frou-frou.
Look, I got years where I had the MRE instant coffee as a dip. And the crap they served you in the defact, I am now at a point in my life where I'm just enjoying the good stuff, and I don't care what everyone thinks. I drink the basic bitch pumpkin spice latte every October, too. Don't hate me. I don't have any problems, though, because I'm too lazy to go and buy them just for October. I wear my sandals all year round, because why not?
I'm not. You hippie.
They're not Birkenstocks, because actually, I thought when I got out of the Army, I'd do that. I'd get the Birkenstocks. But holy crap, those things are expensive. So I got, like, the knockoff Birkenstocks.
I rock like Crocs now.
Oh, man. I'm not cool enough for Crocs. And with that being said, thank you for spending some of your precious time with us. For my crazy co-host, I am J.R. Hanley, and this was the Blasters and Blaze podcast. We'll be back next week at the same time, where we'll indulge our love of nerd culture, cheesy jokes, and all things that go boom. And I want to thank each and every one of you for joining us tonight, David, JC, Michael, Diana. And the takeaway message to your listener is, I'm not cool enough for Crocs, but you could be. So join the conversation and tell us about it. All right, thanks, guys.
Take care.